Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with research fellow at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Laura Hawks, about a really important research article she and her colleagues published in the Journal of the American Medical Association recently about the alarming number of women whose first sexual experience was forced, in other words, rape. Critical issue that we really need to confront. Really looking forward to this conversation. First, though, let's look at a couple research that matters that have come up recently that I think listeners should be aware of. The first one has to do with electronic health records. We understand that electronic health records are here to stay. We certainly can capture data. We certainly can do population health where we can help people get colonoscopies better, help pap smears, mammograms, all the things. We can track those things, really encourage people. We can do this outreach. We can give you your medical records, your notes right after you leave. We can give you all kinds of data, get you your lab results, x-ray results. So these are really positive benefits. The question in this research is how to doctors feel about these electronic health records, because what is not known to most patients is that on average, physicians spend 1 to 2 hours on electronic health records and other desk work for every hour spent with patients. So for instance, yesterday I was in clinic for about 8 hours, and that would suggest that I have between 8 and 16 hours of additional work to do outside of that one clinic to document, follow up, respond. It's really difficult to comprehend that kind of impact. And so what this particular research was a collaboration and published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, one of the top clinical research journals in the country. And it was a joint effort by researchers at Mayo, the American Medical Association, and Stanford, really looking at how do physicians, and they survey 5,000 physicians every 3 years, on burnout, and to what extent changes in society and changes in within the medical domain really affect these physicians and contribute to burnout. They found most recently that 4.5 out of 10 physicians actually say they're burned out. Now, this was glaringly high because the same survey said that the burnout in the U.S. population was about 30%. So more physicians are feeling burnout, and that consequence of burnout in terms of depression and maybe leaving the field. And then they were asked to rate their electronic health records usability by applying a system usability scale that's been used in over 1,300 industries. And it allowed them to compare the electronic health records usability to things like Google search engine, or perhaps the usability of a microwave oven, the usability when you go to try to get money out of a bank, Amazon, all kinds of things. And what they discovered is that the electronic health records came in last of all these systems with a score of 45. There was no other way of putting it. That is an F. And then when they compared it to other things like the Google search engine, which got an A, the microwave ovens and the ATMs and Amazon got Bs, Microsoft Word got Cs. The only thing else that got an F was Microsoft Excel, but it still came in higher than the electronic health record. This is incredibly worrisome, and clearly changes need to occur. So talk with your physician, understand it a little bit more, and at least tell your physician thank you for what you're doing, because it is a lot for a lot of people. The second research that matters has to do with yoga and physical therapy and chronic low back pain. And the great news is that yoga and physical therapy not only help chronic low back pain, they also improve sleep. And this was research published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine from Boston Medical Center, and it looked at 320 adults in Boston who were randomized to receive different treatments with either physical therapy or 12 weeks of yoga classes, a one-on-one physical therapist, and they followed them for 52 weeks to see the long-term benefits of how these did, not only just for chronic low back pain, which works really well. It's better than most drug measures, but also for sleep. And what they found is that the pain that comes from chronic low pain actually had improvement after 6 weeks of treatment in these yoga or physical therapy, or 3.5 more times to have improvements of sleep after the 12-week treatment, showing that both pain gets better, sleep gets better, lasting up to 52 weeks. And I just think this is really kind of amazing. You know, I don't think it's the standard of care yet. The physicians are going to recommend yoga or physical therapy, but they maybe should be. And maybe you and our listeners and my patients can ask our providers and ask me to comment about this and help us get into things that have very few side effects and really mostly benefits. Last research that matters we're going to talk about today is one that's near and dear to me, running. Not because I would consider myself a runner, but I will say I recently completed a 320-mile bike ride from Jerusalem down to the southern part of Eilat, a fundraiser I participated in with riders from across the United States. And in preparation for this ride, yes, I was doing bike rides to, you know, try to get 30, 40, 50, 60-mile rides in to prepare for biking 70 miles a day in the Negev in the desert. But I also, there were many, many days I couldn't because of my work schedule, those electronic health records. And so I just took short runs, and I had not been running a lot, so it wasn't easy, but I would take a 5-minute run, 7-minute run, 10-minute run, 15-minute run. And this research in the British Journal of Sports Medicine says any amount of running is linked to a significantly lower risk of death from any cause. I was just trying to get my heart rate up. I was just trying to make sure I was in better shape, but it turns out that what they suggest is that if people took up running, and they don't have to run far, they don't have to run fast, it'll have substantial improvements. Now, we don't know how much you have to run to reap these benefits, but they did a systematic review of 14 studies over 230,000 people, and they really found that any amount of running was associated with 27% lower risk of death from all causes, and a 30% lower risk of death from heart disease, and 23% lower risk of death from cancer. Now, I can't say that the 2 to 3 months I was running, I got all those benefits, but I know if I keep it up, based on this study, it will be helpful. And I will encourage my patients, walking, brisk paces, running, get your heart rate up, get some practice, get some experience, make this into a lifestyle change. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters portion of our show. A little yoga, a little physical therapy, a little running, and perhaps a little less time on electronic health records could help most people. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Harvard Research Fellow Dr. Laura Hawks about her research on the alarming number of women across the United States whose first sexual experience was forced. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with research fellow at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Laura Hawks, about the alarming number of women whose first sexual experience was forced. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Hawks.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
This is one of those topics that really speaks to so many people, but yet seems to be under the radar continuously, despite the Me Too movement. And I know you just published a really important article in National JAMA Subspecialty Journal, Internal Medicine, and we're going to really talk about that. But I think we first would like to know a little bit more about you. What are you doing professionally, and how did you get interested really in this topic at all about looking at unwanted sexual assaults?
So I am a research fellow at Harvard Medical School, as you mentioned. My clinical work is entirely in the homeless population here in Cambridge. And my research really focuses on vulnerable populations and health disparities. My primary interest is actually folks who are impacted by the criminal justice system. But during fellowship, I've really broadened my research interests to include sort of all forms of health disparities in vulnerable populations. So this project actually was really originated in a conversation with my research mentors when we were discussing that the statistic we knew was available through the National Survey of Family Growth. They asked a question about forced sexual initiation. And we decided to explore a little further to see if there were any health-related outcomes associated with having experienced forced sexual initiation.
Let's help clarify language here. The difference between sexual violence, unwanted sexual encounter, rape, because they have different meanings in different settings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the work we have to do as a society is to sort of better understand what we mean by different terms. For the purposes of this paper, we really stuck with what would be legally defined as rape. So the legal definition of rape is a sexual intercourse which occurs without consent. And the terminology of our paper for sexual initiation is referring to a very specific form of rape, so rape at first sexual encounter. And we determined this based off of a question which the women responded to, which asked, speaking of your first sexual intercourse, would you define it as voluntary or involuntary? That is, was it of your own consent? And given the phrasing of that question, it's clear that the women who reported that their first sexual encounter was forced were defining it as a rape.
So when we're talking about rape, what are we looking at nationally, just really outside of this work at first? Because we'll certainly kind of dive down to this, because I've understood in my work, I was so struck by the number of women. This was not a small number. It was not limited. It was across a lifetime. And I don't know, 1 out of 5, maybe more, maybe 1 out of 3. Help us understand that.
Yeah, so outside the context of our research, which really focused on first sexual encounter, the previous literature and certainly studies actually conducted by the CDC have found that 20% of women will experience rape over the course of a lifetime. However, when you broaden the definition to include any form of sexual violence, so that's unwanted sexual experiences, including but not limited to sexual intercourse, almost 50% of women will experience some form of sexual violence in their lifetime.
And those that are not rape but unwanted sexual experiences would include things like, what are the kinds of things that really fit into this much broader but really important category?
Sexual harassment is a form of sexual misconduct that does not necessarily include any physical touch, so it can include verbal harassment. And sexual assault is any sort of sexual conduct that may include sexual intercourse, so vaginal penetration, but may also include other forms, unwanted touching, groping, physical form of sexual violence that does not necessarily include vaginal intercourse.
So physical, psychological abuse.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. I still find that just unbelievable. And I imagine, and we won't spend a lot of time, but I imagine when we get into international, we find that this can be same, similar, or even worse in many societies.
Yeah. Again, actually, one thing that really sparked our interest in this topic is that it has been examined in many other countries, and it's really never been examined in this way in the United States. So in some European countries, they found the reports there are somewhat less than what we reported in our findings. So the range could be somewhere between less than 1% to up to 5 or 6%. But then in countries, particularly countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the reported frequency of forced sexual initiation was much higher, as high as 30 or 40% in some countries.
So let's dive right into your article that you published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine Subspecialty Journal. You were looking at specifically sexual violence at rape for women in the United States, their first sexual experience. Tell us why that's the area of interest and concern in your main finding.
Yeah, so, you know, a first sexual experience and experiencing violence at a first sexual experience has the potential to have more severe repercussions than experiencing sexual violence later on in life. This is sort of solidified by the WHO considering it a very specific form of sexual violence.
The World Health Organization.
Yes, the World Health Organization considers it a unique form of sexual violence, but it's also, you know, sort of common sense that if your very first sexual experience is one in which you have no autonomy, you have absolutely no control over the situation, that you would be at extremely high risk for having severe psychological and physical health repercussions from that exposure. And it may be more extreme than if you had experienced it at a time point further down in your own sexual experience.
So you were looking at whether they were physically threatened, were they verbally threatened, verbally pressured, whether there were other ways of being kind of coerced. What did you find?
So for all of the women who reported that their first sexual encounter was forced, a follow-up question was asked to sort of specifically describe how that sexual encounter was forced. And what we found is that an alarmingly high number of women reported verbal pressure and also reported that their partner was much larger or much older, which was actually verified by our demographic findings, where the reported age of the assailant was 10 years older than the victim among those who had forced sexual initiation. And so you can imagine that even if physical violence was not used, it was certainly implied because of that power imbalance. But up to a quarter were reporting some sort of physical threat. Another quarter reported being physically harmed. So there was a wide range of forms of violence and coercion which were experienced by these women.
And overall, you found close to 7% of all the women in your nationwide sample reporting that their first sexual experience was rape, over 3 million translating. Is that right?
Yes, and that 3 million estimate is only representative of women aged 18 through 44, because that's the population that's targeted by this survey.
Wow.
So you can imagine if this had been asked of women of all ages, well, the proportion probably would have been similar, although we can't say for sure. That absolute number of women who had experienced rape at first sexual encounter would have been much, much larger.
We're going to need to take a short break, and we're just going to let that sit in for a moment. That's sobering. It's sad. It demands more. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to continue this conversation with research fellow Dr. Laura Hawks at Harvard Medical School about the number of women whose first sexual experience was forced or rape. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with research fellow at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Laura Hawks, about a really important article she just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about the alarming number of women whose first sexual experience was forced, really rape. And Laura, right before the break, I was just letting that kind of sit in, and we were recognizing that if we expanded, you know, your survey to older age groups, we would, I'm sure, have millions more. And despite the Me Too movement, we know people still would be really hesitant. And I'm wondering, in your setting, you know, homeless setting, to what extent are you able to uncover this? I would imagine this is not rare to be seen among homeless as it is among all women presenting to all clinicians.
Yeah, and actually, I just want to quickly touch on a point that's actually related to a finding from our study, and then I'll go into my own clinical experience briefly. But, you know, I think two things are true when it comes to the demographics of the women who experienced forced sexual initiation. The first is that this is something that's happening in alarmingly high rates among women of all races and all socioeconomic status. So it's happening at very high rates among white women, among women of color. It's happening at very high rates among women who are not living in poverty and women who are living in poverty. So that's the first thing that we found. The second is that despite this happening to women of all races and all socioeconomic status, there are certainly women who are at higher risk for experiencing forced sexual initiation. So our study found that women of color, women who were born outside the United States, and women who are living in poverty were all at higher risk of experiencing forced sexual initiation. And that certainly is extremely benefit in the work that I do as a provider for women who are homeless. It's very common for women who I work with who have experienced sexual violence over many different time points in their lifetime, and to have to sort of reconcile that trauma with their current day-to-day life and feeling incredibly unsafe and threatened almost 24 hours a day because there's so little security in the lives that they live.
So as I think about, you know, my own clinical experience, thinking about, you know, many years ago when I had a young college student come in and parents couldn't figure out really what was going on, asked me to kind of get involved. And, you know, after 4 or 5 hours over a couple visits, really working and trying to figure out, like, you know, when did any symptoms happen? It happened with an early sexual experience back home as a teen when a trusted friend forced sexual intercourse. And the shame, the guilt, the trauma all contributed to things that came out a year later. And I'm wondering, how often do these stories come out early versus come out more like this? You know, your provider and someone taking care of you can approach this.
We were really unable to sort of quantify the proportion of women who experienced forced sexual initiation who got any form of treatment for it. But I think that certainly one of the areas that we can target for improvement is to improve the empowerment of women to talk about experiences as they happen with trusted providers, friends, parents. And I think something like the Me Too movement at least does give women a sense of feeling like they're not the only ones, and hopefully will empower women to be more open about these experiences so that when they happen, we as a society can figure out better ways to treat this form of trauma and to help prevent some of the downstream consequences.
You did have some data that you looked at that says, well, what are some of the things that they do experience later on, some of the medical problems? What are a couple things they might likely end up talking with your doctor about that could be related to this sexual trauma?
Yeah, so we looked at three different categories of health outcomes. The first was reproductive health outcomes, so that those relating to birth outcomes later on in life. The second was gynecologic health outcomes, and the third was general health outcomes. So we consistently found that among women who reported forced sexual initiation, they had sort of increased findings that their sexual autonomy was affected. So they had higher likelihood of having an unwanted first pregnancy and a higher likelihood of having an abortion during their lifetime, which are both just sort of signals that this may have affected the sense of control that women have over their sexuality later along in their life. Another finding that was very consistent was in our gynecologic health outcome category, we found that syndromes of chronic pelvic pain were consistently more likely to be diagnosed among women who reported forced sexual initiation. So that included having a history of pelvic inflammatory disease, having a diagnosis of endometriosis, or having problems of ovulation or menstruation. And you can imagine that all three of those conditions are going to initially present in the doctor's office as some form of pelvic pain that is not managed. And so again, that just is sort of suggesting that this form of sexual violence may be manifesting itself as chronic pelvic pain. And then the third category of health outcomes we found were general health outcomes. So we found that women who had forced sexual initiation were more likely to report their general health was fair or poor compared to good or excellent. They were more likely to report having difficulty completing tasks outside the home. And they were also more likely to report illicit drug use, although the proportion reporting illicit drug use were really, really small in both groups. So essentially, you know, we're finding significant downstream associations with this exposure.
What do we know about groups that perhaps were underrepresented or that you didn't survey in terms of sexual violence? I'm thinking now about what appears to be astronomically high sexual violence in, let's say, a transgender population. Is this something that researchers are looking at and that you all may look at in future surveys?
It's certainly something that needs to be researched. And I would say one of the main downfalls of this survey, which we actually did not design ourselves, it's a survey that's conducted by the CDC, and it's the National Survey of Family Growth. And the results are publicly available, so researchers can take their data and analyze it, which is exactly what we did. Some major shortcomings, especially in terms of what we need to know as a society about sexual violence, are that one, even though they have a survey specifically for the male population, they don't ask any questions about forced sexual experiences among men. And while certainly it's likely that this is happening at much higher frequencies among women, it's also certainly happening among men and boys. And we have to better understand exactly how frequently it's happening and exactly what the consequences of that might be. So you were simply not able to ask that question with this data set.
So for sexual experiences on young men by older men, you know.
Or women.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. It happens that older men and older women may create conditions of sexual violence for young boys. And actually, I received some, you know, this study was published 2 months ago, and I received some personal emails from men and boys who said that they were sexually assaulted and they wish that I had included that population in my study. And that was actually something I recognized before it was published, that I was regretful that I wasn't able to include that population in our analysis. But it was really brought to light by the personal emails that I received.
Wow. Should we be asking women and men, you know, when you had your first sexual experience, if you've had a sexual experience, was it for? Should that be part of our routine clinical questions, given your data?
You know, I think that's a really good question. And sort of as you suggested, I think that it's actually more important to understand if our patients were experienced sexual violence early on in their sexual experience, that probably the significance of that very first encounter to a patient may feel a little bit arbitrary. And so for us to really understand exactly what sort of trauma they experienced early in their life, I think is the more important clinical question.
And then in terms of the criminal justice and the public health movement, is there an implication for each that you think and your colleagues think is important?
Speaking generally in terms of public health, I think it's really important that we think about prevention of sexual violence, specifically of forced sexual encounters. And that really the most important and most impactful way we can do that is through transformative justice. So preventing this from happening by really cultural change. So that means empowering women in all spheres, starting from kindergarten to college and then on to our employment spheres as well. And sort of really, I think, as highlighted by the Me Too movement, being more open and really holding folks accountable at a personal level in terms of some form of reconciliation after this happens. I think that in terms of, you know, the criminal justice system, there's an extremely high rate of both men and women who experience sexual violence if they are also justice involved. And so, you know, targeting that population for interventions, both prevention and treatment interventions, is also extremely important.
So last question, you know, this is such a personal issue. I've had so many friends, women, colleagues who've been affected by this, and it's difficult to talk about. So I really, first off, want to thank you for being our guest and allowing us to have a conversation. But how is doing this work and now talking about this work, how's it affected you?
It certainly has been an extremely moving project in unexpected ways. I think the amount of attention that this received from the media, which was an extraordinary amount, did actually inspire some hope in me that as a country, we may be ready to embrace this topic in a more serious way and actually impact meaningful change. And I think that it's also really impacted how I treat my patients and also people that I love and care for in terms of talking about sexual violence, talking about how it may impact them many years later, and also in terms of thinking about consent and how I would talk to young patients about what consent means to them, or even talk to my future children about sexual consent in the future. So it's been incredibly moving and changed my thinking both in my personal and professional sphere.
Well, on behalf of your health listeners, I really want to thank you for bringing us along with you on your journey, letting us participate in that journey, and inviting patients and providers and public health and the criminal justice system to all play a role in reversing and changing what happened. So thank you so much, Dr. Laura Hawks.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
We've been talking with research fellow at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Laura Hawks, about her research on the alarming number of women whose first sexual experience was forced, rape. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And a listener can send us any issue or concern by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura, what do we have?
Our first one is, I was with my father recently with a new doctor talking about his back pain. The previous doctor my father had seen, without even an exam, had said the back pain was from arthritis. My father is obese and he doesn't speak English, but I do know that it's hard to diagnose someone without an exam. The new doctor said the back pain was actually on my father's side and mid-back, which is not normal for low back pain. He found that the pain started when my father twisted suddenly and felt something pull. The doctor started pressing along a rib, and when he found an area that was tender and pressed harder, my father winced. This led to a diagnosis of a rib fracture. Seems like a good history and a good exam are still quite important in medicine.
You're here.
Yeah, right?
You're here, yeah.
It's pretty self-evident there.
Well, it's always self-evident when you look backwards.
Sure, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah, the second doctor was not necessarily looking backwards. They were doing it in real time. Mm-hmm. I think they had the benefit of the fact that you had a patient and family that were dissatisfied, which is usually a red flag. But also, let's just call it what it is. You know, mm-hmm. if you don't take a good history and you don't perform an appropriate physical exam, then you know, that to me sounds really problematic.
Right.
And I don't think it's good care. And I wouldn't like it myself. You know, I was taught in medical school that you take a history. If you're still in doubt what the problem is after you do the history, you do a physical exam.
Okay.
And then if you're still in doubt, you go back and take more history.
Interesting.
It's suggested that laboratories and studies and x-rays, while important, they were the confirmation.
Yeah.
And that the great majority of what you ever learned was from the history exam and then more history.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it sounds like there was an assumption this patient's obese, whether there were language barriers, culture barriers,
right.
You know, and that patient communicated that there was back pain, and the doctor said, I've seen 20 cases of low back pain this week from people who are overweight and obese. That's this. And it's probably arthritis, and, you know, we can treat that with ibuprofen.
Right.
But no, it wasn't that, because the history here was different. So a lot of times going to like, well, when did this pain start? If it only started a month ago, you've never had it before, and it started when you were twisting, it would suggest that it could have been a muscle pull. But you could have been twisting violently enough and lifting something that you could actually break a rib. I mean, people don't think anything being breaks loose with a lot of trauma, but sometimes just a twisting motion in the right circumstance puts enough torque on the ribs, particularly if they were lifting something at the same time. And I think going along and finding that space, and then the doctor probably had some suspicion. That's why they kind of poked right on that rib.
Oh,
I bet that hurt like the dickens.
Yeah, well, it's a shame that this patient was in pain for longer than necessary to get this diagnosis. So
yeah, and I mean, you know, the first doctor might say, well, I got the wrong diagnosis, but you know what? The treatment was the same and it wasn't going to change. Well, that's not really the full story, is it?
I mean, I'm no doctor, but it doesn't seem like it at all.
No, you know, trust is the hallmark of the physician-patient relationship.
Right.
And so if you don't have the trust, maybe it doesn't impact on what happens this time, but the next time, maybe the patient's not going to come see you. In this case, the patient would see a different doctor.
Yeah.
What's our very next house call, Laura?
My husband's sister committed suicide many years ago, and my husband has had a really hard time ever since. He won't talk about it, and when asked, says he's fine. But I've noticed around the anniversary every year, he gets irritable, pretty short-tempered, and anxious. How can I get him some help when he doesn't acknowledge the problem?
Oh, that's really hard, isn't it?
That's a tough one.
That's really hard. Well, first of all, thank you for acknowledging the problem.
Right.
I would imagine you've tried to speak to your husband and say, you know, sit down and say, you know, I really want to talk with you. I think you could also say, I really want you to come to the doctor with me and get in to see your primary care doctor.
Interesting.
And just say, I need you to be there with me. And then you can confront it. I would really like to go with you when you see your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have permission to communicate to your doctor? Anything that might raise an alarm and help your loved one get into therapy, because clearly it's affecting him and affecting you and the unresolved trauma, unresolved grief.
Yeah, understandably so. I mean, this is, yeah, exactly, a huge trauma that he went through.
There's likely guilt. There's likely anger. There's a lot of emotions that are tied up with there, and around the anniversary, oh my goodness, it will, but it can get better. That's mm-hmm. the whole point. It's not like we want you to go see someone because, you know, we just want you to see it. We want you to see
yeah.
it because actually a trained professional can actually help and make your relationship and the way you're feeling better.
I actually wonder if our listener is talking to somebody herself too, because to be caring for somebody
yep.
going through that trauma is also a hard place to be in.
Yeah. Well, good luck and thank you for sharing. What's our very last house call, Laura?
My mother has had Alzheimer's for 7 years now, and there's not much change week to week, but I do notice a change when I think back every 6 months or so. She barely recognizes me, but she will eat and drink still. My doctor asked about hospice, as I do want to keep her at home, but I do not have the resources to do so right now. How do you know when it's time to bring hospice in?
Well, thank you for a question that I think is on a lot of people's minds as they care for loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
I will say Alzheimer's and dementia are chronic diseases and chronically fatal diseases.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so you can expect that there will be decline and their prognosis is as bad as cancer,
mm-hmm.
You know, really. And so as things are declining, you have to say, you know, when and what were her wishes, what were her advanced directives, you know, hopefully they're there. A lot of people say, you know, when it gets to a space and place where I can't really respond or understand
right.
or recognize, don't keep me alive by artificial means. That may well mean saying that, you know, we think it could be less than 6 months to live and hospice might be appropriate. Hospice has all kinds of services. They can help with aides and support and social workers and at home and visiting and medications and can be really, really helpful keeping someone at home. Maybe it's not 6 months, but it certainly could be. And I think that's a reasonable question and space to explore.
If this listener contacted hospice and sort of got the ball rolling, do they talk about expectations like that pretty early on? I mean, could they talk about these concerns and thought processes sort of after that initial contact?
Well, they can, and they have to accept, obviously, referral. The physician has to make a referral, but they certainly could have the first conversation and see. And there's so many different ways to be involved with hospice. There's
right.
some where you say, you know, someone's going to pass away within days or weeks.
Right.
The others, it's going to be months. And that doesn't mean you can't continue doing what you're doing, but you're probably going to say, I'm not going to do heroic things anymore. I'm not going to do many procedures anymore.
Right.
I'm not going to really admit the patient to the hospital much anymore. And the loved one has to be okay with that.
Right.
So, well, we want to thank all our listeners today for really good house calls. We want to thank all of you for joining us also for today for your health. We hope we've tackled some issues that are important to you in your health. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, or send us questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Laura Hawks, and our executive producer, Laura Lacey. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.